to finish off this week, we're going to study the third in the series of what Bhante Nyanamuli called the three cardinal discourses of the Buddha. And they really are a very good introduction to the Buddha's teaching. So regardless of whether you have some background in Buddhist studies or have no background in Buddhist studies, it's a really good way to get to the core of what the Buddha taught. In fact, I gave a talk a long time ago, and I haven't given a talk on these three since, but it struck me at the time that these three suttas together make up such a comprehensive teaching, and they really hit upon, each one has its own nuance, its own unique way of exposing or of relating the same truths and the same teachings. And it also gives a very clear, in that way, it also gives a very clear example of how the Buddha would tailor his teachings to those who were listening. But it's a unique example. These three suttas are unique in that they're all very much to the core and very profound and dealing with the core subjects. And they really do cover all the bases. And so they have probably the clearest example of how the Buddha would tailor his teachings, because we have these three pillars of, if you will, of the Buddha's teaching, that, and we're seeing how he would use each of these three pillars. I mean, in some way, these three are, they're not, of course, the only important suttas out there, but they are unique when put together in this way. So it's a great thing that we are studying them. Okay, so what happened that made the Buddha? The first thing we're going to do is talk about what made the Buddha teach this sermon. What was leading up to it? So where we left off, the Buddha had just finished enlightening his five disciples, and he's still in the deer park of Isipatana. Now, after staying with these five monks for the whole of the Vasa, the rainy season, during the time that he was in the Vasa period, as if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, during the Vasa, there were. It looks like there were a few things that happened. No, there was one important thing that happened, and that is Yasa. Yasa was the son of a rich man who lived in Varanasi, or Varanasi, which was where the deer park was located. If you've ever been to India or been to the Buddhist holy places, if you haven't, highly recommended to go. If you have, you'll know that Isipatana is actually quite close to Varanasi. And so this young man, Yasa, he was very delicately brought up, and one night he saw, just as they say the Buddha saw, he saw his attendants, his women, I don't know what you'd call it. In that time, rich men had lots of women surrounding them that just catered to their every whim. And so he fell asleep early, and they saw that he was asleep, and so they all fell asleep and lay down wherever they were going to lie down. And when people are awake, of course, they can appear as attractive as they wish, but when people are asleep, it's quite difficult to maintain any sort of illusion of attraction or to maintain this attractive state. So some of them would be scratching themselves, some of them would be drooling, some of them would be all contorted into different positions, some of them would be having nightmares and murmuring or talking in their sleep. And here's what the text says is, the hair of one had become unfastened, another was dribbling, others were muttering. It seemed like a charnel ground. When he saw it, when its squalor squarely struck him, he was sick at heart, and he exclaimed, "It is fearful, it is horrible." And so he was disgusted by this, and he would have been enjoying sensuality for the whole day and not being satisfied, and now he realized that really what he was mired in was this mass of human flesh that he had surrounded himself with. It was really just flesh and bones and like a charnel ground. He saw what he was really mired in its natural state, free from the illusions. And so he became disgusted, and he walked out of his home in the middle of the night, not knowing where to go, and he was saying to himself, "Oh, this is it's terrible, it's horrible. This place is like a charnel ground. It's fearful." Well, that's what he said. And of course, he walked to the deer park, and this would have maybe been a place where people like to walk when they wanted to be in nature. It might have been a special place in the area where you'd find. Peace and quiet. So he thought to find peace and quiet there, and he went quite close to where the Buddha was staying, and he was muttering out loud, "It's fearful, it's horrible, horrible, what to do?" And the Buddha said, "Here it's not fearful, here it's not horrible. Come, Yasa, sit down, I shall teach you the Dhamma." And Yasa heard this, and, well, anyone who hears the Buddha calling them, very difficult to resist. And he thought, but he was enticed by the words, "Someone telling me that they have something that's not horrible, a way out of this prison that I'm in." And he now finds himself in a prison. And so the Buddha sat down and gave him instruction, and he became a Sotapanna. He became a Sotapanna, and then his father came looking for him. His father saw these golden slippers. He was at night, realized that his son had gone away, and so he went looking for his son, or maybe it was early in the morning, I'm not sure. And so he went looking, and he followed him to the deer park and was looking around for his son. And the Buddha had Yasa sit in such a way, he made a determination in his mind that Yasa should not be seen. And so the father didn't see Yasa. And so the Buddha said, "Well, sit down." He said, "Have you seen my son?" And he said, "Well, sit down, and it may be that after some time you'll see him." And so he sat down, and the Buddha started teaching him as well. While he was teaching, he became a Sotapanna, and Yasa, hearing the same teaching a second time, became an Arahant. And then he made Yasa become visible, because now he knew that Yasa would not ever return to lay life, so he thought, okay, now he's free, and we'll show him again. And so Yasa's father saw his son and said, "Oh, come home, your mother, come back to your home, your mother is sick with worry." And the Buddha said, "It's not possible for Yasa to go home now. He's become an Arahant." And Yasa's father was, "Wow, that's incredible. That's what a great gain for him." And then he thought about it, and he said, "Well, then come both of you and receive alms in our home." And so Buddha had Yasa ordained as a monk, and they went together to Yasa's home, and the Buddha taught his mother and his wife, ex-wife at this point, and they became Sotapanna as well, and these became the first lay disciples of the Buddha. And then, because Yasa was such a well-known person in the area, four of his friends, these are Vimala, Subahu, Punaji, and Gawampati, became monks following Yasa. They heard that he had become a monk, and they said, "Well, what about us? Why don't if he thinks it's a good thing, let's follow him." And so they also became monks. And then 50 of their friends, it says, became monks. So this might have been over the 3 months, because Yasa would have been Yasa's family would have been very well known, and it may have been that the Buddha's reputation had begun to spread, and so people heard about this and came and listened to his teaching. And in the end, 50 more people became monks during that Wasa period. So this is important to relate because it is the very beginning of the Buddha Sasana. It's actually not related to our sutta directly, but it's helping us to understand where this is, what the background is. So this is what the Buddha said, and this is a very important speech of the Buddha. It's the very beginning of the Buddha Sasana, really, where the Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, I am free from all shackles, all bonds, whether human or divine. You too are free from all shackles, whether human or divine. Go now and wander for the welfare and happiness of many, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, welfare, and happiness of gods and men. Teach the Dhamma that is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end, with the meaning and the letter. Explain a holy life that is utterly pure, perfect and pure. There are beings with little dust in their eyes who will be lost through not hearing the Dhamma. Some will understand the Dhamma." And this is the exhortation that the Buddha gave, and it's one that's always referred back to. In brief, we say, "Charatta bhikkhave, charatta bhikkhave." Go forth, O monks, or wander, O monks. Bahut chana sukhaya, bahut chana hitaya. For the benefit of many, for the welfare of many, and so on. And so this is where he sent the first 60 monks. Now, it's after this that I believe Sariputta and Moggallana came. Think about that, where exactly Sariputta and Moggallana came in. Yeah, it's a little bit later. But anyway, the Buddha said, "I'm going to Uruvela." And so he went to this place, Uruvela, which is actually quite close to, or fairly close to where he became enlightened. So here he is near Varanasi, and he walks all the way back to Uruvela, which is, I believe, quite close to Buddha Gaya, where the Buddha became enlightened. He goes to a place called Gaya Sisa. And if you look at the beginning of this sutta, the Buddha says, "Ekang samayang bhagava gayayang viharati Gaya Sise." So he was staying at Gaya. And Gaya is the area where you find Buddha Gaya. The city of Gaya, or the town of Gaya, is about 5 kilometers from Buddha Gaya, which isn't really a village at all. Buddha Gaya is just a place in the jungle, really, where the Buddha became enlightened. It's now become a Buddhist center, the Buddhist Mecca, if you will. Okay, and then Mara comes to him, and he has a discussion with Mara, and Mara comes to him, but Mara comes to him several times, so we're not going to pay much attention to that. He comes to the Buddha again and again for 7 years. So he was sent out wandering by stages to Uruvela. Another thing happened on the way, that there were 30 men, and this is a fairly well-known story in Buddhist circles, of these 30 men, the Baddawagi, I think they're called, these well-to-do group of men. And they went sporting in the woods with their wives, except one of them didn't have a wife, so he hired a courtesan, or I believe that's just a euphemism for prostitute, I'm not sure, an escort, I guess is the word we use nowadays. And she turned out to be not a very good person, and it was a bad idea to invite her, because while they were all resting, asleep, I believe, she stole all their jewels and their money and everything and ran away. And so they all got angry and upset, and they went to help find the woman. So they were wandering about, and they saw the Blessed One sitting at the root of the tree. They went up to him and asked, "Lord, has the Blessed One seen a woman?" And the Buddha said, "Boys, what have you to do with a woman?" And they told him what happened. And so this is after this he said, after they told him, he said, "How do you conceive this then? Which is better for you, that you should seek a woman or that you should seek yourselves?" A profound question. No, could you imagine? Here they are passionately searching for this woman to find, to get their jewels back, to get their wealth back. And the Buddha just throws them a curveball and says, "Well, what's more important, that you find you retrieve your jewels, or that you find yourselves? And this has often been mistaken, actually, to mean that the Buddha taught a self. So I hope by the last sutta it's pretty clear that the Buddha didn't teach any sort of self. It's a play on words. He used the word self many times in many different ways, but it means to look inside. In fact, it's a useful thing to talk about the self when you're teaching people, to tell them to look for themselves, to find themselves. You know? Just being, you have to be clear that it's just a figure of speech. And so they said, "Lord, it is better for us that we seek ourselves." And he says, "Then sit down and I will teach you the Dhamma." And so he sat down and taught them. And they all became arahant. And they became monks. So, this is where we come to the beginning of this sutta. The Buddha then made his way to Uruvela. And in Uruvela there were three matted hair ascetics, fire worshippers, called Uruvela Kassapa, Nadi Kassapa, and Gaya Kassapa, three brothers. And this is another fairly famous story. It's a really good story, actually. It's not really that doctrinally important, but it's kind of funny. And it really does set the tone. I mean, if you were to make a movie out of the Buddha's life, you'd really get a lot of these vivid images of, you could really play on a lot of this. In fact, this book that I'm reading from would make a great audio book. I think if I ever get a group of people here together, we'll sit down and we'll record this whole book in audio. It's called The Life of the Buddha, and it's in the form of a play. He put them together in a form of a dramatic performance. It's not a dramatic performance, but it's in the perfect form for an audiobook. Okay, so the Buddha went to these three fire worshippers, and he had an idea in mind. His whole idea for going to Uruvela was that, this is what we surmise, is that what he really wanted to do was to bring the Dhamma to Rajagaha. Now, in Rajagaha, most of the people in the area worshipped these Kassapa brothers who lived up on the mountain in Uruvela. So if he went to Rajagaha without dealing with these three first, he would have quite a difficult time convincing people to give up their ways. But he must have understood that if he took down these three, if he brought these three under his teaching, you know, if he taught them and was able to humble them and make them to come around to see the truth of his teachings, he would have a much easier time, of course, bringing it to the people of Rajagaha, including the king, because the king was to become one of the great Buddhist patrons. And so he went to see these three first. He went to see the eldest one, Uruvela Kassapa. And he performed a great number of miracles. And if you read the story, it's kind of amusing to listen to the miracles that he performed. He, in the beginning, he asked if he could stay in their fire house where they have the their fire worship. And they said there was a great snake in there, a great naga, a serpent, a dragon living in there. So in this time, apparently, there were dragons or nagas living in the world. Nowadays, all we have is these little lizards on the wall that go kuk, 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 that you hear behind me. But they had bigger ones back then that were poisonous and fire-breathing and so on. And he defeats the dragon and puts him in his alms bowl. They all night they see them. They see this fire coming in the fire hall, and so they think, "Oh, he must be killed." And he comes out in the morning with the snake, the serpent in his bowl. And then he goes to live nearby, and then all of these angels come and visit him and light up the whole forest, and they ask in the morning, "Who came to visit you?" And he says, "Oh, last night the four great kings came to see me. Last night Sakka, the ruler of the gods. Last night Brahma came to see me," and so on. And every time the Buddha performs a miracle, Kassapa says to himself, "Oh, the great monk is very mighty and powerful, since he can perform these miracles. But he is not an arahant like me." So with all of these great miracles that the Buddha performs, and apparently he performs 3,500 miracles in total, Kassapa keeps saying again and again, if you read through this, he says, "Ooh, he's a great ascetic, but he's not an arahant like me." And so Kassapa, all the people from Rajagaha come and they're going to do a great sacrifice. And Kassapa becomes very afraid that, if people see this Mahasamana, this great ascetic, performing miracles, they won't have any faith, they'll lose all their faith in me. And he said, it would be good if he made a wish for, may he not come tomorrow. And the Buddha thought to himself and realized the mind of Uruveda Kassapa. And so he flew through the air and went for alms. No, did he fly through the air? He went for alms somewhere else. Yeah, he went to the northern continent of Uttarakuru and gathered alms food there. He just flew through the air. And then he took alms food to the Himalayan lake Anotata, which is a very special lake, mythical lake, that has become mythical in Buddhist circles, somewhere in the Himalayas. And he ate there and passed the day there in his bliss of enlightenment. Then he came back in the evening and Kassapa asked, "Where were you all day? We set out food for you," pretending that he actually wanted him to come. And the Buddha said, told him where he went, and he said, "Oh no, I was staying in the Himalayas for lunch." And Kassapa says, "Oh, he's very powerful, but he is not an arahant like me." And so on and so on and so on. And then they have this sacrifice and they can't split the wood. They're trying to split the wood and it just won't split. And they think, must be because of the great monk's supernatural power. And so they went and told the Buddha, and the Buddha said, "Should they be split?" He said, "Please let them be split." And the Buddha said, "Okay, then let them be split." And poof, suddenly all the logs were split. Anyway, it goes on like this for a long time. And eventually, why I want to talk about this, there's something very interesting here, because the Buddha's, whether or not you believe all these miracles, the Buddha's methodology here is something that I've experienced myself. Dealing with some people, no matter how you give them the opportunity to gain faith, they hold, and no matter how ridiculous their faith seems, they will hold to it like a treasured possession. Like this is an example one of the monks gives when he's giving a teaching, the Payasi Sutta, I think it's called, in the Digha Nikaya, a debate with a skeptic. And eventually this guy, you know, he's just holding on to his views, and no matter what the monk says, he doesn't listen, he keeps saying, I don't believe you. He says, "Well, what do you think of this? Suppose there were a man who found a whole bunch of cow droppings, because in India they like to collect cow droppings." And so he put them all in a basket and put the basket on his head and went walking on his way. Now suppose there was a storm all of a sudden, and the cow patties got all wet and they started streaming down his face and got him into quite a disgusting mess. And someone came up to him and said, "Look, you why don't you throw those cow patties down? They're just making you into a disgusting mess." And suppose the man were to say, "Oh, you don't know what you're talking about. These cow patties are for my pigs. This is food for my pigs." And then he said, "Well, do you think this guy would be talking wisely?" And the man said, no, that would be stupid." He said, "In the same way, you are holding on to this view. It is that you are holding on to these views, and I tell you, drop them." And eventually, he admitted that he just wanted to hear this monk's teachings. But here we have, eventually, the Buddha comes to this point where he says, "This misguided man will go on forever thinking, but he is not an arahant like me. Suppose I give him a shock." And this is exactly what you have to do. I did this once for a woman. She had practiced with another meditation teacher, and she came to practice with me at Doi Sutep. I always remember this one, because I was trying to explain to her the difference between rupa and nama, the difference between one object and the next object, to help her to see that things arise and cease. But she would never answer my question directly, because she had no faith in me. She had seen that I was teaching something different, and she saw that I was quite young, and I was quite inexperienced. And so she kept saying, I don't understand your point of view, or something like that. And I was trying to say, are they one thing or are they separate things? You know, is this one, are these two objects one thing or separate? She said, "I don't know where you're coming from," something like that. But she refused to answer several days in a row, until finally I said to her, "No, you're wrong. Listen, they're separate things." And from that point on, she was really easy to deal with. Once I just hit her with it and said, "No, listen, I mean, it really is just this way." And then I started explaining to her why it is that way, and I didn't give her the opportunity anymore. And after that, it was like a relief for both of us. And she went on with her practice. And this is what the Buddha does. The Buddha, instead of giving him the opportunity to realize for himself, "Gee, maybe I'm not an arahant," he says, "Kassapa, you are neither an arahant, nor are you on the way to becoming one. There's nothing that you do by which you might become an arahant or enter into the way to become one." And at that point, he prostrates himself with his head at the Buddha's feet and says, "Please, let me become your follower." So the Buddha tells him to check with his students first, and he checks with them. He says, "Look, I want to become a monk under the Mahasamana. You may do as you think fit." And they're like, "Yeah, we've been waiting for you here. I mean, this guy's been performing miracle after miracle. We've had faith in him since the very beginning. Just been waiting for you to get your head around this." And they say, "If you lead the holy life under him, all of us will do likewise." This is him and 500 of his students. And so these 500, they all shaved off their matted dreadlocks and took all of their religious articles and put them on a raft and sent them down the river, or just threw them into the river and let them float away. Now, Uruvela Kassapa's brother was down the river, Nadi Kassapa, was halfway down the river, and he had 300 students. And he was there, and he saw these things coming down the river, and he thought, "Something happened to my older brother," and he went to find out. And when he found out what had happened, he also took all of his followers and became followers of the Buddha. Then there was Gaya Kassapa, who was in the place near Gaya Sisa, I guess, or at the bottom of the river in Gaya. And he saw the stuff coming from both of his brothers, and he thought, "Oh, something happened." And so he went up, and he also became a monk with all of his 200 followers. So 500 plus 200 plus 300 plus 200 is 1,000. And that's where we get the number of 1,000 bhikkhus, as you see in the beginning of the sutta. So that, in brief, is the story of how we get to where we are now. After this happens, and the Mara comes to the Buddha again, I don't know. I don't get why this is here, because he says, step by step for 7 years I have followed the... Ah, yes, for 7 years. Because 6 years he was following when the Buddha was torturing himself. And so he comes and he tries to torment the Buddha. He says, do you now dream in woods immersed in sorrow? Have you lost wealth, or are you pining for it? And so on and so on. And then he replies to all of it. Mara will say a verse, and then Buddha gives a response, and so on. And then Mara starts crying. He says, for 7 years I've tried to possess him. I don't know what he tried to do. And he says, a crow there was who walked around a stone that seemed a lump of fat. Shall I find something soft in this? And is there something tasty here? He, finding nothing tasty there, made off. And we from Gotama depart in disappointment too, like to the crow that tried the stone. So like a crow trying to eat a stone thinking it was a lump of fat. He broke his beak. And then what's interesting about this, why I mentioned it, is because this is where Mara's three daughters are said to have come. So they come and they try to tempt the Buddha, and this is an important story in Buddhist history, because the three daughters are the most beautiful, sensual, they're the epitome of sensuality, and the Buddha basically ignores them. And then they come back to Mara and they're all sad, and he says, you fools, you've tried to split a rock by poking it with lily stems, to dig a hill out with your nails, to chew up iron with your teeth, to find a footing on a cliff with a great stone upon your head, to push a tree down with your chest, and so you come from Gotama frustrated. And without further ado, we now come to the fire sermon. So, these are the events in between the last sutta and this sutta. The sutta is fairly straightforward, but how we understand it, what I meant by saying it's a different way of looking at the same things, is what you'll see if you read through this, is that rather than talking about the five aggregates, we're no longer talking about the panchakanda. Now all of a sudden we're dealing with a whole different framework, and that is the six senses. So we have the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind, or the heart. And so it might be a little bit, it probably isn't confusing, but in case you're confused or wondering why it is that the Buddha is talking now, how this relates to the five aggregates, well, actually, it's the same thing, and I believe I mentioned it last time. The five aggregates arise at the six senses. So when you see something, there arises the five aggregates. When you see, there is the rupa khanda, the eye and the light touching the eye. There is the vedana khanda, so you feel happy or unhappy about it. At the moment of seeing, you feel neutral, according to the Abhidhamma, but because it's not painful to see, right? The feeling of the light touching the eye is not painful, so there's no painful or pleasant. There's a neutral feeling. But based on it, of course, there arises pleasure and pain, as we'll see. But at any rate, there's a feeling. Then there's memories or perceptions. You recognize what you're seeing. When you see someone's face, there's a part of the mind that is recognizing the face, you know, using the brain, I guess, to recognize. Then there's thoughts, what you think of it, your mental formations, liking or disliking. And then there's the consciousness which sees. If the mind is not at the eye, you don't see anything. So it takes the consciousness to actually see something. The consciousness has to advert to the object, as they say. So it's actually the same thing. But using the six senses gives a really vivid imagery. What we have here is the Buddha has taken these fire worshippers and he's performed all these miracles, and now he's led them up to the top of this mountain, I guess, Gaya Sisi, Sisa means head, so the head of Gaia, which would be this rock. I remember when we drove through Gaia for the first time, I was always looking up at the rocks and thinking, maybe it was that one, maybe it was that one. There's these rocky outcrops in the area, and you think, oh, maybe it was one of these that is called Gaia Sisa. And I really wondered which one was Gaia Sisa. I wonder if they've found Gaia Sisa, or if they know what that is. They may be, it may be quite clear where it is, but I was just looking. And here, yeah, up at the top of the mountain, maybe in nature, he says to them, all is burning. Apparently T.S. Eliot uses this, not apparently. T.S. Eliot has a poem called The Fire Sermon, I believe. And it says it starts with burning, burning, or something like that. All is burning, or something like that. Which is based on this sutta. But it's vivid imagery, you know, all is burning. And using the six senses and talking about them as burning, that's what's really burning. Talking to these fire worshippers who, for them, fire is a very vivid image, something that they can all grasp quite easily. But regardless of who you're talking to, this is a very powerful simile or metaphor or image, the idea of the fire. So basically we're burning up. This is what the Buddha is saying. Sabbang bhikkhave aditang. And what is this all that is burning? What do we call the all? Sabbang kincha bhikkhave sabbang aditang. And he says the eye is burning. Forms are burning. Eye consciousness is burning. Eye contact is burning. Also, whatever is felt as pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, that arises with eye contact, arises based on. The word paccaya doesn't mean indispensable condition, but that's basically what it means. But the word is just it arises based on, or arises with contact as its condition. That too is burning. So let's stop there and try to understand this first sentence, because it's actually, he's saying two different things. This first sentence is, I think, the first glimpse we get, unless you're if you're reading back, but it's the first, when the Buddha became enlightened, he was talking about these things, but it's the first teaching that he gave to someone else on paticca-samuppada. Yeah, or it's the first glimpse at what would later become a formalized teaching. He doesn't give a formalized teaching of paticca-samuppada. He does that later. I believe he does it later. He hasn't done it yet, I don't think. But he gives the formal teaching once the Sangha is established and once he can set it up as a doctrinal teaching. But at this point, he's trying to convert people. And these guys are I believe none of them would be sotapanna at this time. So they're all still unconverted. They're all still unconvinced. So he doesn't give a deep doctrinal teaching. He starts off with something that they can understand. But what he's talking about, if you're familiar with paticca-samuppada, you know, you can see the glimpse, you can catch the essence here. Paticca-samuppada starts with ignorance, and then ignorance leads us to do thing to do karma. Based on our karma, we will be born and give rise to this state of rebirth that we find ourselves in. And then there will arise these consciousnesses. So there, because of the consciousness, there arises the body and the mind, which is the eye and the awareness of the eye consciousness. With the eye and the eye consciousness, and then the rupa. So based on nama rupa, based on body and mind, there comes the six senses. Based on the six senses, there comes contact. So there's the contact between the body and the mind. And the mind contacts the body and is aware of seeing, aware of hearing, aware of smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. And then based on that, there is vedana, there is the feelings. So it's exactly what the Buddha is saying here. It's just eventually it becomes systematized. What the Buddha is saying here is that there is this process of seeing. And basically it's a meditation teaching. It's one that we can take to heart right now. If we want to, while we're studying this, we can turn it into a meditation practice. So what is real? What is really going on right here in front of you? You can see the computer screen. Well, actually, that's light touching your eye. Bet you weren't aware of that. You knew it intellectually. But until I said it, it probably wasn't in your line of vision, or until you read it in the page. And you remember, oh yes, this is light touching my eye. And so you can say to yourself, seeing, seeing. You can become aware of this phenomenon that we call seeing. There is the consciousness. When the mind goes to the eye, then suddenly you start seeing. When the mind goes to the ear, then you're hearing again. Most of the time it's so jumbled up that we can't even tell that it's happening one by one. Until you practice intensive meditation, when you're on a meditation course, then you can break it up into pieces. But otherwise it's going so fast and the mind is so slow and dull that it seems like it's just me, seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting and feeling and thinking all at once. But actually it does happen one by one. And so we have the chakku, the eye, the rupa, the light, and then we have the vijnana, chakku vijnana, which is the consciousness. When these come together, there is the chakku sampassa. Chakku sampassa, the contact that occurs at the eye. Now, based on this contact, based on this phenomenon of seeing, there arises what is most important. Is the happy or unhappy, the pleasant or unpleasant, or the neutral feelings. And this is where the fire arises. It's just like bringing together all the kindling and tinder and lighting a fire. When you have it all together and you put it all in a pile and make it all up, and then you rub two sticks together and you get a fire, or you light a match or a lighter or so on. Then poof, it all burns up. This is the moment of contact. This is also the first time that the Buddha, I believe, goes into the three akusala mula. So we can, here I'll highlight this to let you see what I'm talking about. These are the three akusala mula. So there are three roots to all unwholesomeness. He uses the word raga here, raga, but it really means loba. It's the same word. Raga means lust. It's maybe a more emphatic way of saying loba, but loba just means greed or desire. Raga is a little more emphatic, but means the same thing. So this is truly what you see when you start to look at these things. And this is, so he's leading these guys on a meditation practice. You have to remember, these are not ordinary people. They're people living in the forest who have already been doing some pretty heavy focusing on this fire that they worship. Now you imagine, fire worship is not a simple thing. It's something that gives you great concentration. I remember when I had to light fires, we lived in the, totally on a tangent here, but we lived I grew up in the snow, no? In a country that has lots and lots and lots of snow. And one year we forgot to put the wood, we cut all this wood, and we didn't forget, we were lazy, and so we didn't put the wood away into the shed. And so all winter we were digging out frozen wood from under the snow to light in our fires. And you can imagine, frozen wood covered in snow doesn't burn so well. And yet somehow we managed to cut it up into small splinters enough in order to create fire. And it became quite a meditation practice. having to take this toothpick-sized splinters and making a teepee out of them, and taking little scraps of paper and burning it and getting it to the point where the wood, this little toothpick's dried out, and then you got bigger toothpicks and so on. And that's doing it with a candle or with matches and a candle and lots of modern equipment. You can imagine what it must have been back then when these guys had to actually rub two sticks together, or that you have to keep a coal overnight and make sure you're always keeping, or butter lamps, keeping the fire always burning. It becomes quite a worship, quite a meditation practice. It was a big thing in India, and it focuses your mind. You know, people like fire. That's why today people still like fire, because we've been worshipping it life after life after life. If you read some of these, there was this story that I read, fictive history, you know, talking about those times and the ways they had to worship the fire, and just how important it was to them, because if you didn't treat it with worship, you lose it, and then you have to rub two sticks together again, which is never fun. So, but the point being that these guys were heavy into meditation already. All the Buddha had to do is divert their, or change their focus from concepts like fire to realities like vision or sound, or seeing or hearing or smelling and so on. And so, as I was saying, this is what you really see when you look in this way. You see that they're truly on fire. The first thing that a meditator has to grapple with is this chaos in the mind that's on fire, really. Wanting this, wanting that, wanting the silliest things. When you practice meditation, the silliest things come to you. We had a discussion today about food. One of the meditators, I think they're both probably fed up with the food here. The food in Sri Lanka is the same food day in and day out. And that doesn't bode well for a life of getting the kinds of food that you want. So one of them said to me a couple of days ago, he said, you know, it's just funny. I never drink pop. I never drink soda pop. And yet today I was miserable because here I have no soda pop. At home I could have soda whenever I wanted. And he said, but I don't drink normally. I don't drink soda pop. And so the mind comes up with all of these crazy things, and it's quite disturbing. It's one of the wake-up calls that comes to meditators, the wake-up to how nasty we are inside. And of course, the anger that we have. Sometimes you find yourself raging. I've had meditators angry at me and so on for just no reason. Having to come to terms with all of this rage that we have inside. And you see the moha and the delusion. You see your arrogance and your conceit and feeling like you don't deserve this or you don't deserve that. And so you'll sit around miserable in your room thinking of, with delusion, thinking of how happy you were at home and so on. Delusion is a scary, scary thing because it lies to you. It tricks you. It makes you think that when I get good food, I'm happy, right? When I get the food I want, I'm miserable here because at home I could have... And then I was so happy. It was so much peace and bliss at home where I could get the food that I want. And this is why it's kind of fun being a monk, because sometimes you do get the food you want. Sometimes you don't. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you get really good food. But it never satisfies you. And the problem is that we forget that. We lose sight of that as soon as it's gone. And then when we're hungry again, we think, that was good food. Wish I had that again. But during the time that you're eating it, it's really not satisfying at all. It does nothing for you, except give you more greed and more craving. And so eventually the meditators are able to let go and to see that this is delusion. This is all, it's greed, it's anger and delusion. And it's fire. It's really the fire, because without these things, it wouldn't matter what you see or hear. there would be no fire at all. You could see and hear, and you could eat all the kinds of food that you want, and there would be no danger, there would be no suffering coming from, there would be no dissatisfaction or upset when you get unpleasant food or when you don't get pleasant food. And the mind will find true peace and true happiness. So for this reason, the Buddha said it's on fire with these things. What else is it on fire with? Well, it's on fire with some things that should be familiar to us. Jatiya jaraya maranena sokehi paridevehi dukehi domanasehi upayasehi aditanti vadami. This is really something that you have to hear. It's too bad most people here probably don't, well, many people here probably don't know Pali, so it kind of falls on deaf ears. But if you hear this, when you chant it, it's very powerful. And for people who understood what was, for these people who understood what the Buddha was saying, it's something that is very, it's a very emphatic, powerful speech. Aditanti vadami, it's on fire, I say. Upaya sehi aditanti vadami. So what's it on fire with? Well, it's on fire with everything that we learned about in the first sutta. It's on fire with suffering. Right, the eye, and this is one example of why people will often think that the Buddha is talking, when Buddha talks about birth, old age, sickness, death, or birth, old age, and death, that he's only talking about moment-to-moment death, moment-to-moment birth. This seems to suggest that birth is referring to the moment that you begin to see. So at the moment of seeing, there is birth. When the seeing ceases, that's death. So people say the Buddha didn't teach about the past life, the Buddha didn't talk about rebirth or reincarnation or so on. And you know, it's just such a funny argument that people have, and there's this big argument that goes on in Theravada Buddhism about whether the Buddha actually taught about the past or the future lives. And I don't really follow the whole gist of it, it kind of seems like a silly argument. Because it's quite clear that the Buddha was talking about moment-to-moment birth and death in the majority of his suttas. The core teaching of the Buddha is about the present moment. Right? There should be no argument about that. But then for people to go and say, well, then that means the Buddha never talked about birth, old age, sickness, and death in terms of concepts, you know, the birth of a being and being reborn. The Buddha never talked about that. The Buddha didn't teach that. It's an absurdity, really. I mean, first of all, why wouldn't he? Even if you pretend that all of the Buddha's teachings on past lives and future lives are just later additions or they don't exist, it still makes very little sense to think that the Buddha would be so dogmatic and strict as to never admit or never engage people on the level of concepts, which he did again and again, talking to people about their best way to live one's life and how to go to heaven and so on, really as a means of bringing people closer to this moment-to-moment realization. And if people are vying or are striving ceaselessly to go to heaven, well, the best thing you can do for them is to help them to see the truth of heaven. Start to talk to them about what does it mean to go to heaven and what you need to do to get there, and talk about how heaven is a conditioned state. It comes based on causes and conditions, and those causes lead you to go to heaven. And unfortunately, when the power of those causes ceases, heaven also ceases, and that's the end of your life in heaven. So it helps people to come to this understanding that really the way out of suffering is not to be born in this state or that state, it's to see all of becoming as fire, and to give it all up and to be free from attachment to becoming anything. So I would say that even though it sounds like the Buddha is talking about birth in terms of a momentary thing, I would say he's also giving a nod to the beliefs that were current at the time and saying the fires that arise at the eye lead to these things, leads to all kinds of suffering. So it is true to say that it's on fire because it's arising and ceasing, and that's birth and death. That's very much how the Buddha taught. But it's also true that based on visions that we have, sounds that we have, even smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts that we have, we become reborn. It leads us to give birth to so many things, even in this life. When you see someone else, see your parents working in this way or that way, you decide, I want to be like them. Or you watch some actor on television in Hollywood and you think, I'm going to be like him. Right? I'm going to be like her. I'm going to be just like them. And so you start to emulate them and you give rise to a being. No, this is birth of something. It seems not at all a far leap to go the next step and say, well, at the moment when you die, this continues on. Right? When you die, the mind does the same thing. Now it's got no body left, leaving the body behind. All it's got is its impressions, thinking about the things that it's seen and heard and smelled and tasted and felt and thought, and putting it all together and saying, I want that, and chasing after it. This is why when people die, all of this stuff sort of comes crashing down and comes together. This is what people say, my whole life flashed before my eyes. Because it's where the mind suddenly gets a jolt and is jolted out of this human state. And so suddenly it's faced with all of, with an unhindered view of itself. The mind is able to suddenly see all of its memories without the interference of this physical lump of flesh, the brain. So this is the power of focus in that moment is why you start to all of your life flashes before your eyes, or many things flash before your eyes. This is verified in meditation. When people come to meditation, they develop some of this focus. And this is why meditation allows us to work out many of our issues. Because all of these same things that would have come up if you were on your deathbed now have a chance to come up in meditation because of the focus that you develop in meditation. When you're meditating, many of the bad things you've done, the good things you've done, the bad things people have done to you and you've held on to, all of your emotions and your addictions and your phobias and so on, they all come up for you to look at, for you to understand. In meditation, it can be quite difficult, forcing you to deal with all of your attachments and fears and wants and needs and so on, all of your all of the things you cling to. And so this is what, at the moment of death, based on everything you've seen and heard and so on, that is going to lead you to be born again. Once you're born again, it will lead you to get old. It means you have to get old. It means you have to die. And in whatever lifetime you're in, it means you have to have sorrow, lamentation, and pains and griefs and despair. And this is because of our attachment, because we cling to this and that, or we're upset about this or that, and we have thoughts and ideas about this or that, and we cling to our ideas, and it gives us all sorts of suffering. So, very profound teaching. It really sums up very nicely the Buddha's teaching, just in this one paragraph. Really the essence of this sutta, I think. There's not so much more. Because then he goes on and talks about the ear is burning, and sounds are burning. The nose is burning, odors are burning. And by repeating it, you can imagine the effect. Of course, this gives the monks a chance to reflect on all of these things, starting with the eye, and they're like, yeah, that's the way it's working, and they can see how it's working. Then he talks about the ear, and suddenly they're thinking about the sounds and seeing the sounds arise and cease. And maybe it's a good sound or a bad sound, and it gives rise to liking and disliking. I guess the complaint people have about dealing with past lives and future lives, you can't really be mindful of them. It really does you no good. But intellectually, it's a useful tool because it would help these monks to give up their wrong views and to come to gain right view. understanding of what is suffering and what is the cause of suffering. Because when they think about it, they would say, oh, all of this greed and anger and delusion that we have is going to lead us to great suffering. It is suffering right now and it's suffering in the future. So it's not unthinkable that there's at least part of what the Buddha is talking about here is just conceptual, to help, because so much of the Buddha's teaching has to be, before he can get them to meditate properly, it has to be dealing with their wrong views. If people have wrong views, they can meditate all they want and they'll just go round and round in circles, and maybe they'll end up in the Brahma realms, maybe they'll end up in heaven or so on. But they'll never come to see the truth as long as they have wrong view. View is very important. So part of this is giving meditation teaching, part of it is dealing with their wrong views. And in that sense, talking about concepts can often be useful, talking about death and so on, rebirth. But yes, most important is this moment-to-moment awareness. So talking about the ear and the nose, and then he gets to the tongue, talking about food. So they wouldn't have been eating now, so it's obvious that the Buddha's not totally a meditation teaching, but it's a views-based teaching as well, helping them to overcome their wrong views. The tongue is burning, the body is burning. Now the body is something that they would have been able to experience, just as we experience here. We have heat and we have cold. You'll find that it's very difficult actually to sit in one position for any given time. Maybe you have to itch this, scratch this or that. You have to adjust your position because there's pain or aching. Maybe you feel too hot, so you have to adjust your clothes, or you feel too cold, so you have to put something else on. Maybe you're hungry or thirsty, or you have to urinate or defecate, and so it's all a great amount of suffering in the body that is not generally visible to us, because we learn how to block it out and avoid it, how to deal with it. But actually, it's quite an ordeal, this body. Our likes and dislikes, our attachments to certain sensations and our aversion to other sensations. It leads us to cultivate and leads us to really to cling to this body. And that's why we're born again as human beings. As we become very strongly to identify with this body and get very used to this state of being. And so if we act accordingly and develop tendencies accordingly, we'll just come back as a human being. So when people think, oh, it's neat to think about rebirth, well, ask yourself if you'd like to come back as you again. Some people might say yes, and they'd say yes, because then I could do things better. I agree. It'd be nice. If I had it all to do over again, that'd be great. Start off hopefully a little bit wiser anyway. And avoid all those things. The problem, of course, is that you don't remember much, if anything, because of all of the torment and all of the shock that comes from having a new body and all of the memories that get blocked away by the jolt into a new body, and all the memories that you lose in the womb over 9 months just getting used to this freaky new existence in your mother's womb. That's one thing. The question Claudia asks, is death painful? Now, death need not be physically painful. It can be very physically painful. My grandmother died in great pain. But death is suffering, because it's great suffering in the mind. Death has the potential to cause great suffering. And as I said in the first sutta, actually, these ones, birth, old age, sickness, and death, don't have to be in this way. Don't have to be suffering in this way. They're intrinsically suffering because we learned in the second sutta they're impermanent, because they can't be controlled and they don't last. So they're suffering in the sense of not being happiness. But to say that death is suffering, it's only suffering in an ordinary sense. For people who still cling, and that's most of us, right? When you die, can you say, You're not going to be afraid, and you're not going to be sad to leave your children behind, or your parents behind, or your friends and your family behind. If we were to die today, we can think how sad we would feel, how much clinging there would be in the mind based on our attachment to the people and the things around us. So it can be a great amount of suffering, and it can be mentally very, very painful. And finally, we deal with the mind, and it's fairly self-explanatory, but there's something that has to be explained, I believe, ideas. He uses the word ideas to explain Dhamma. It's not that hard to understand. But it Dhamma here means ideas is a good, very good translation, I think. It's actually a good translation of Dhamma anywhere, and you could use Dhamma to mean idea, but it's not etymologically it's not what the word Dhamma means. And it doesn't quite get to the point that anything that arises in the mind, anything that the mind takes as an object. I'm trying to think here. Well, maybe ideas is the best, because we're not talking about the other five senses. So we're talking about something specifically in the mind. It's a thought or an idea. Basically, when you think, our thoughts and our mental activity. This is all burning. And you see, the Buddha is careful not to say that these things are bad in any way. He's saying, he's telling the Four Noble Truths in a different way. He's saying, these things are only suffering because of the fire. And what's the fire? The fire is old age, or the fire is lust, hate, and delusion, greed, anger, and delusion. And then he's implying here, he's giving a implicit teaching that then leads to birth, old age, sickness, and death. Or could be, as people say, that it's talking about the birth of these things, because they arise and they cease. And because of the fire, the lust, the hate, the delusion, they give rise to sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. Our thoughts can do this to us. All six of these senses can do this to us. But thoughts can be the worst when people sit down and think and obsess over ideas, obsess over thoughts, and turn ordinary situations into a big deal. Then the mind will start burning. You know? Our memories, when people did bad things to us or bad things happened, they can torture us. I think I gave this example of a woman who came to meditate at our center in Thailand at Doi Suthep, who looked like a ghost. And she was 41 years old, and when she was a child, her father had raped her. And I assume it had been many, many years since, but she was still holding on, and her mind was on fire, clearly on fire. She was in terrible suffering. And it was quite heartening to see how she changed over time. She eventually became a nun for some time, and actually got into helping other people learn how to practice. But her whole face changed, her whole being changed, and she went from looking like a ghost to actually being a human being again. She was able to put out some of the fire. Okay, so that's the first part of the sutta. The second part should be familiar from the last sutta. It's using a different base now. But what's the word we're using? We come up with the same word, nibindati. You have this word, nibindati, which again doesn't mean estrangement. It means disenchanted. Chakkusmimpinibindati rupe supinibindati chakkuvinyane pinibindati chakkusampase pinibindati yampidang chakkusampasa paccaya upajjati vedayidang sukang va dukang va adukama sukang va tasmimpinibindati. So it becomes disenchanted with the eye, with forms, with the consciousness, with eye contact, and whatever is felt as painful or pleasant or painful or neither pleasant nor painful that arises with eye contact as its condition, in that too he finds, he becomes disenchanted. So I think it should be incredibly easy to understand what the Buddha's talking about here. He's basically saying that there's nothing wrong with these things, and we're not meant to hate them. Actually, all of these things are ethically neutral, and this is really an important point that we have to make, that the eye is ethically neutral, the light that we see is ethically neutral, even up to the point where there arises a feeling, even to the point where something makes you happy or something makes you and brings you pain, or since you feel some sort of bodily pain, it's still ethically neutral until it gets to the mind, and until the mind picks it up and runs with it. This is what we call javana. The mind picks it up and runs, and so in running it judges, and then it says this is good or it's bad. And that's where the fire arises. So he's pointing out that there are two aspects of reality here. There's the object and then there's the reaction. There's the experience and then there's the reaction. Our experience isn't the problem. It's not the problem that we see nasty things or that we hear terrible sounds or we smell or taste or feel or even have to think of terrible things. It's that once we grab these things in our mind, we run away with them, we extrapolate on them, make more of them than they actually are. As a result of this, we fall into torment and suffering. And we create the fire. When one sees, as I was explained this in the last session as well, when one sees this process, one sees where the fire is, one loses the passion for these things. One loses one's interest, gives up the tendency or the habit of chasing after or of giving rise to liking, disliking, greed, anger, and delusion. Simply through seeing clearly, when one sees clearly again and again and again how suffering arises. How does there arise sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair? It arises through clinging. And we see this again and again and again, you get bored of it. Another way to understand nibindati, it just means bored. So people, when they come to meditate, when they reach this stage, they become very bored. And things that were actually kind of interesting before, they'll come on this day and they'll say, nothing is interesting. They'll be able to tell you that it seems like it's the same thing over and over and over again. Because this is what you realize, is that actually all of reality is just the same thing over and over and over again. There's nothing intrinsically different about any experience. It's like putting the same six ingredients together in different amounts and getting all sorts of seemingly interesting and exotic results. When you break it down, you see that actually it's just the same thing over and over and over again. And so you become bored and disenchanted, come to see that this isn't a way to find happiness. It's only a way to develop clinging and to build up more and more and to carry around more and more of a burden until it overwhelms you and you're not able to cope with it. And hence, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. But at this point, the meditator's mind starts to turn away and they start thinking, rather than how can I get more of this, how can I get the good ones, they think, how can I get out? How can I become free? And as I said before, this is why the meditators will often run away, because they experience things that are unpleasant, and they begin to try to find a way out. And the only way out they can think of is to go away, to leave. Of course, when they go home, they realize that the same problems are still with them. So mostly they're able to continue, and when they continue, they come to see that the true way out is, if we scroll down here, we see I cut this up wrong. I have to cut this up correctly, just a second. There. So when they become, normally when a meditator reaches this stage and then they want to run, they want to escape, they will start to look closer and to see what it is that they're doing wrong that is leading them to this problem. And so they find the true escape, which is not outward. The true escape is inward. It means in not going there, not pursuing that course of action which leads to suffering. And so eventually the mind gives up all action, gives up all karma, and it decides not to intend on anything, and to simply interact with life rather than react to it and give rise to more. So all sankhara, this avijja paccaya sankhara, all of our sankharas will stop, meaning we won't want to create anything. Nibindang virajati. Maybe look at this. Virajati. And this is all the same from the last sutta. Virajati means passion fades out. So you lose your passion. You come to see that passion was a mistake and it didn't lead you to any goodness whatsoever. With the fading out of passion, vimuchati. Poof, one is free. We realize that the only thing that's keeping us bound to suffering is our own passion for it. That we're actually passionate. We want to suffer. We want to go in and we want to experience these things because we don't see them. We don't understand that they are truly suffering for us. Once we understand, we become dispassionate and free. Vimuttasming vimuttamiti jnanang hoti. You gotta love how the Buddha's conciseness of words. He doesn't mince words here. Vimuttasming, when he's free, he knows what? I'm free. Vimuttasming vimuttamiti jnanang hoti. I don't understand the grammar there, because there should be a long A. My Pali's terrible. Vimuttamiti, I would have thought. But it may be something else there. Oh, vimuttang iti. Maybe it means vimuttang iti. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't mean vimuttami. Jnanang hoti, there is the knowledge of being free. What other knowledge is there? Kina jati, birth is destroyed. Now, this is really, I think it's a good proof that the Buddha was not just talking about birth as being a momentary birth, even though, as I've said, that's very clearly an important part of the Buddha's teaching. He also gave a nod, or accepted this idea of being reborn. Kina jati, birth is exhausted. Well, if birth was talking about momentary birth, then it's not exhausted, because here he is realizing this. This is the 16th stage of knowledge, when one comes back from realizing Nibbana and says to oneself, wow, that was cool. That was something new. What was that? And realizes that something has changed. And for an arahant, when one sees Nibbana often enough to become arahant, the realization is that kina jati, birth is exhausted. Ursitang brahmachariyang, lived is the holy life. Katang karaniyang, and as I said before, this is a poor translation in my opinion. what should be done, not what can be done. It should be what should be done, has been done. Or done is what should be done. Done is what is to be done. Na parang ittayati pajanati. He knows there is no more beyond here. There's nothing more beyond here. Idamavocha bhagava attamanati bhikkhu bhagavato bhasitam abhinandung. This is what the Buddha said. The bhikkhus were glad and they approved of his words. Who wouldn't? What a wonderful teaching, no? Maybe some people don't like it. It's actually hard for many people to bear, I think, if people are mired in sensuality and find that to be the way out of suffering and the way to find happiness. This can be a terrible thing for them to hear. Most people would probably not like to hear this at all. People who don't yet see the danger in clinging, who haven't yet experienced any sort of great suffering and been unable to cope. They're still on the upswing. They have good luck, for example. And then what happened? Imasmin cha panavaya karanasmin banyamane tasa bhikkhu sahasasa anupadaya asavehi cittani vimuchingsu. I should just put vimuchingsu. This chatang is misleading. Vimuchingsu. So they were freed from the, liberated from the taints through clinging no more. How do you lose all passion and not fall into sloth and torpor? It's a good point. I mean, passion generally is associated with energy, no? But you have to understand that there are two kinds of energy. There's good energy and there's bad energy. People who want to kill others will do so with great energy. I suppose it's true that there is a great amount of energy that comes from passion, but it doesn't mean that without that passion there is negative energy or there is a negative state. It just means that there is no excess of energy, right? Passion leads to a positive energetic state in the sense of intending to do something. The state of an arahant is one of natural energy. So the arahant might not ever seem energetic at all, but their natural state of clarity of mind is one that has a perfectly balanced energy. So it's right in the middle. It's not the case that it's a false dichotomy, I guess, is what I'm saying. You're setting up a dichotomy here that if you don't go one way, you have to go the other, which is certainly not true. When a person gives up passion, it doesn't mean they fall into the other extreme. When a person gives up their energy, their desire to do things, they don't just sit around like a log and do nothing. They act naturally. And in having a natural mind or a mind that is free from any clinging, they have the perfect amount of energy. My teacher is a good example, and I don't want to say he's an arahant, but there are many people in the world who believe he is, and I've talked good about him many times, but he's approaching 90, I think, and the last I saw of him about a year ago is unstoppable. I mean, he's very tired a lot of the time, but the amount of energy in him for someone in his 80s is incredible. Most monks his age are just sitting around doing nothing. He is flying to Bangkok and constantly giving teachings from morning to night. He wakes up at like 3 a.m., sleeps maybe 4 hours, if that, 3-4 hours. And then he's up doing his meditation and then doing his chanting in the morning. And then he comes and does a group chanting at 4:30. And then he gives a talk at 4:30 to the monks who are there. And this is if he doesn't have some appointment that he's whisked away to in before it gets light out. And then who knows where he's having lunch, maybe on the road, maybe at some monastery where he has a ceremony that he has to participate in, or a meeting he has to go to, or someone's house that he's been invited to, someone's birthday party, some huge celebration. If he's still in the monastery, then in the morning he has to meet with people. Even before he goes on alms, people will be waiting to talk to him and ask him questions. Then after he goes on alms, there's the official meeting where he has to meet with meditators, and he'll meet with them and give them teachings. And then he gets one chance for a break in the afternoon now, because he's getting old. And so they give him some time in the afternoon where he doesn't do anything, and he's in his room, maybe sleeping, maybe meditating. I don't know exactly what he's doing. But at his age, sleep might not be out of the question. And then at around 3 or around, say, 4 o'clock, he gets up, and at 5 o'clock he has to meet with the meditators, and he's meeting with meditators and doing evening chanting and doing ceremonies, giving meditators precepts, and meeting with people well into the evening, say 9 o'clock. And then who knows what, he's in the evening you'll see him at his desk studying, reading a book, saying that he has very little wisdom. He apparently has said this. People ask him why he's studying, and he says, I have very little wisdom, I need to improve. And so he studies, and then at about 11 p.m., after doing another night chanting before he goes, he would go to lie down. And then gets up the next morning without any sign of fading. He in the evening he starts to tire. He starts to get tired because he's old now. When he gets up in the morning, he's like a new person. And it's amazing to see him every day without ever complaining, without ever getting upset or getting stressed out at all. But he doesn't seem energetic. He just is full of natural energy. He's able to just continue on, and it's like watching a river. Now, the river just goes naturally, but it keeps going. It's like, why doesn't the river ever stop? And you wonder why he doesn't stop either, and you can see it's quite magical to watch him just continue to flow. Is energy formerly used on worldly pursuit now available? Yeah, that's a good way of talking about the Dhamma. That's the same goes with happiness. People think happiness has to be found in this or that object, but you free up so much happiness by not pursuing objects. So people who are worried about, oh, if I give up these things, where will I find happiness? That's because you give up those things that you find much more happiness that's been freed up. And I suppose the same goes with energy, and the same goes with clarity. I mean, your mind is so much clearer because you're not focusing. It just so much good comes to you. Energy is a part of that. Clarity is a part of that. Happiness, peace, contentment, so many good things. Losing passion makes you more productive. That's really interesting. Most people would argue against that, right? People don't want to hear, and many people don't want to hear the idea of becoming passionless. Passionless, boy, that sounds dull, no? It sounds dull because we're addicted to it. It's the same reason why bad food doesn't appeal to us, because we're addicted to good food, and we think, when I get good food, I'll be satisfied, and you won't be satisfied. You won't even be that happy because of it. A little bit of pleasure. Well, there you go, Claudia. Yeah, I'm more productive than ever now. More productive than I ever was when I was full of worldly passions. For sure, it's true. Someone put a comment on YouTube that I didn't reply upon and reply to. So I'm a celibacy one. But I just didn't want to get into an argument. But he put an argument saying that celibacy was, he said celibacy doesn't have any, or sex doesn't, he said sex doesn't have any, sexual activity doesn't have any effect on one's mental clarity. And, you know, it's amazing to hear that. Well, not amazing, of course, people say these things, but it just doesn't jive. I mean, any kind of sensuality, any kind of sensual indulgence dulls the senses. Lao Tzu said it very well, I think. I don't know exactly what he said, but it was something like, seeing dulls the eye, hearing dulls the ear. and so on. You have to hand it to Lao Tzu. I think he was a Pacheka Buddha. After having sex, is it a good idea to meditate? It's incredibly difficult to meditate after you've had sex because your mind is dull, no? I can't believe people think that your mind can be clear after that. Your mind, I think you'll only see the dullness if you're actually meditating. And that a person who meditates after they indulge in any sensuality for any period of time, they'll realize the dullness, the complacency, the stickiness of the mind in the mind. But if you're not meditating, it's just same old, because you're always mired in sensuality. This is how the Buddha said. When people came and asked him difficult questions, he would say, "How could someone or when they argue with him, they said, "I don't understand that." He said, "Well, someone mired in sensuality like you, how could they be expected to understand that?" It's just a statement of fact, something that's difficult for people who are mired in sensuality to understand. It doesn't mean I'm trying to say everyone has to become celibate. Of course, everyone should become celibate, but that's different. No, you can meditate and have a sexual life as long as it's a wholesome one, in the sense of not cheating on your partner or not lying about your relationships or breaking your commitment to other people. But it's going to have an effect on your meditation for sure. People have there's all these good studies about these things, good studies about how good it is for the body, which is horrible, a horrible thing to encourage people. Encouraging people to eat more, encouraging people to exercise, work out, encouraging people to cling to their bodies more by saying, sex is good for you. Higher attainments would probably be impossible. Yeah, I think so. I mean, your mind is very much dulled by sensuality. There's no question about it. It doesn't mean you have to feel guilty about these things. It means you should learn about them. And when you learn about them, you'll see it for yourself and you'll naturally be disinclined towards it. You really, sensuality, especially the sexual act, is something that you have to come to terms with. You can't avoid, you can't repress. Something that eventually you're just going to have to look at and be totally honest with yourself. Admitting that you have this attachment, looking at it and saying, so what is it? And as you look at it, if you're mindful and if you use the meditation technique that we have, say wanting, liking, feeling, or so on, eventually it will turn into mist. It will vanish like a mirage, because it's nothing. It's just an attachment, just a whole bunch of delusion, a whole bunch of greed bound up with delusion. And eventually you'll see that, and then it's like it never existed in the first place. Just poof, gone. In a cloud of wisdom. No, once you have wisdom, it's gone. You know, it keeps coming back because in the beginning there's not clear wisdom and understanding. Once the wisdom comes, it will never come back. Of course, what that really means is once you see Nibbana, once you realize, once you give up the arising. So, hey, you know what we forgot? I forgot to do the beginning, the preliminary homage. No? Got so caught up in telling my story. We can do the closing homage. But first, we have to discuss what we're going to study next week. I'm guessing that the case may be that nobody has any thoughts on what we should do next week. And if that's the case, then I'll just think of something myself. But assuming there may be people out there who have been reading the suttas and who can think of a good sutta that we can study next week, I'll put it out to you. Any ideas? I'm not even really sure what sorts of sutta we should be studying or what sorts of suttas make good study material. This is my first time doing this sort of course. I have to think about, I think something that's fairly broad-based would make a good sutta discourse, like the Salaika Sutta is a good one, but Mahasi Sayadaw already did that one, so I don't know if we want to go through it. Yeah, I'm not that good of a teacher to be able to do the Salaika Sutta, I don't think. I need something more to go on, like there's a good one, one that I like, the Sabhasava Sutta that I always talk about. But we could study the Satipatthana Sutta. That's always a perennial favorite. Actually, what I'd really like to study is the Satipatthana Samyutta. But I don't know if there's a translation out there. I meant to look and see if there's a... Does anybody know of an online translation of the Satipatthana Samyutta? Samyutta it's actually a group of suttas. See, the Satipatthana Sutta is the sutta on mindfulness, the four foundations of mindfulness. The Satipatthana Samyutta is a whole group of discourses that many people have never read that are very similar to the Satipatthana Sutta but give a little bit more context to the Satipatthana Sutta. MN 148. Yeah. The Majjhima Nikaya is also always a good one. That's what Bhikkhu Bodhi did, a whole slew of talks on the... I think he even covered the whole of the Majjhima Nikaya. There's a lot of good ones in there. You know, the Vibhangavagga, Bhadekarata Sutta, that's a good one. But the problem with the Bhadekarata Sutta is it's just a verse. Oh no, we got the first one. The first one's good. The Bhadekarata Sutta, it actually deals with it. Why don't we do the Bhadekarata Sutta? That's an excellent one. Lahati Padopama Sutta. Yeah, I'm trying to remember which one is the Chula one. I've actually translated that one. I did a translation. I didn't write it down, but Chulahati Opama Sutta. Hati Padopama. Chulahati Padopama Sutta. Janu Soni comes to see the Buddha. Right. How you tell a great elephant? You have to actually see the elephant. Yeah, he's going to go through all of these. He goes through virtue, abandoning the hindrances, the four jhanas, the three knowledges. Ooh, this is a deep one. Okay, well, we've got, I'm going to recommend the Bhadekarata Sutta, and Vinita has said the Chulahati Padopama Sutta. So we've got two suggestions. Do you really think 148 is good? You say it's similar to what we studied today. Let's look at it. It's basically the same, but it's much more detailed than the one we've done. Well, we can do any of these. I'm gonna make a list. Yeah, I've got all the translations here. Okay. Going to suggest, where did that go? Bhadekarata Sutta, one of my favorites. I think it's a okay, well, thanks everyone for coming.